This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit CrestviewHutch.org. This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit CrestviewHutch.org.
Have you ever heard or used the word or phrase peachy keen jelly bean? Does anyone know that? I first heard it in the movie version of the musical Grease. One character asks Rizzo, "How have you been?" And her reply was, "Peachy keen jelly bean." So, how you doing? I'm well, good, fine. That's the sense of it. And we love seasons in our life that are peachy keen jelly bean, right? We love when things are going well, when things are good, when we can just say, fine. Someone can ask us how we're doing and we can reply with, good, yeah, things are fine. It's a great time. Yeah, good. We're peachy keen. And in fact, it's such the norm that many of us answer that, and inwardly our lives can be a wreck, right? So that's just the standard answer. How are things going? Fine. How are you? Good. It's just how we are. Peachy keen, jelly bean. And when it comes to the intersection of our faith and life, we often think that peachy keen, jelly bean is the norm. We think that if we're walking with God, then things will inevitably lead to this kind of living. That because we know Christ, anybody could ask us, how are things going? And that's the norm. How are things going? Good. Fine. Great. But I'm not sure where this kind of thinking came from. This wasn't the case for Jesus. You wouldn't have talked to Jesus at any point of his life and said, well, how are things going? He wouldn't have said, peachy keen, jelly bean. I mean, the Pharisees want to kill me. I'm on the run. This was not the case for him from one view. Now, I know what you're saying, like, well, he was the Son of God. He knew he came to die. Yeah, that was, yeah. But Jesus told his closest followers that in this world you will face tribulation. That's what he told them. He didn't say, oh, there may be a season. Most of the time it's going to be good, but he just said, you're going to face tribulation. Peter told his readers that when the fiery trial comes upon them to test their faith, they should not be surprised. This is something strange was happening to them. Okay? And what happens to us whenever that happens to us? We're shocked. Like, God, you're actually making me go through this? I thought we had a deal. Like, I believe in you. And then everything's peachy keen, jelly bean. And I am facing a fiery trial. So Peter's saying, don't be surprised when that happens. It's the norm. Or Paul even connected the dots in this way. Those who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will face persecution. So this is often what God's plan is for our life. This is why Jesus said, the way is a narrow way that leads to life. I'm reading Paul Miller's brand new book called J-Curve, Dying and Rising with Jesus in Everyday Life. And here's what he says. He asks this question. Is my life's goal a suffering-free life? If we want to be free of suffering, our life will be tragic and shallow. If dying and rising with Jesus is our master narrative, then we can look forward to a rich life filled with adventure, hope, and joy. So, if your life is easy and always simply peachy keen all the time, you're abnormal when it comes to the ways of God. So, having said all that by way of introduction, you're welcome. Happy Sunday. We turn the page to 1 Samuel 26, and we're not surprised at all to hear that David has been betrayed again. In chapter 26, for the third time in three chapters, David's going to be tempted in the wilderness. He's God's anointed one, and he's going to be tempted in the wilderness. Will he trust God, or will he try to fix this in his own strength? In chapter 24, the first temptation came. David clipped the corner off of Saul's robe and immediately he had to deal with a conscience that wouldn't allow him to act so brash when it came to the Lord's anointed. Last time, in chapter 25, David was slighted by Nabal. And rather than just forgiving and moving on, he sorted up his entire team quickly to right the wrong. He was ready to shed the blood of his own people to have his way. But through Abigail, God restrained him from working out his own salvation. And in this chapter, we can be curious to see if David has learned anything. Is this going to be any different than what we've seen for two chapters? What's this third temptation going to show? And so my purpose today is simply to show you some of what you can expect when you trust God and pursue his plan and his way. What can you expect when you trust God and pursue his plan and his way? Now, on the one hand, some of you in this room may think that if what God promises isn't simply good times like peachy keen jelly bean, then why would you ever want this? And Jesus responds. Here's how Jesus put it in Luke 14. Jesus said, "Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you desiring to build a tower does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's begun a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king going out to encounter another king in war will not sit down first and deliberate whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? And if not, while the other is yet a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So therefore, any of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple." So here's the deal. What God's after in not only giving you a heart, is not only just giving you a heart that can cope with all the junk of the here and now, he's offering you life eternal. And so are you going to trust him? Are you going to trust that his way is best, even in this life, if it's met with tribulation, that having him is best? That in him is life, and life is the light of men. And that's who Jesus was. And now in him we have life and have it to the full. A relationship with him by faith is seeing that the best life you can have in this world is found in relationship to God. And so today I'd hope you'd turn from lackluster living that you may know in this world to a life of trust in Jesus. And if you're a believer, you've done this. So you've passed from death to life. You've put all your confidence in the one who promises pleasures forevermore, life eternal. We believe that the best life is found in him. But there's still a lot of heart work to do when it comes to the here and now. So just the fact that we probably are pushing back in our hearts and making a case for why we don't have to face persecution or why we shouldn't have to face any hard times is proof. Because it seems like if God is for me, there sure seems to be a lot of people who are against me, right? So it may be great that God's for me, but what do I do with all the people in life that are against me? Trusting God and pursuing his plan and his way doesn't mean that all of life is peachy keen. So we'll try to make sense of this today by looking at David's life. And so I invite you to join me as we see three outcomes of trusting God and pursuing his plan and his way. Three outcomes. What can we expect? As the other shoe drops, if we trust God and pursue his plan and his way, what can we expect? Three outcomes. And let's begin 1 Samuel 26, verses 1 to 12. Let's read there, and then we'll keep walking through the passage. Here's what we read there. "Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, 'Is not David hiding himself on the hill of Hakilah, which is in the east of Jeshimon?' So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph with 3,000 chosen men of Israel to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped on the hill of Hakilah, which is beside the road on the east of Jeshimon. When David remained in the wilderness, when he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies and learned that Saul had indeed come. Then David rose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. And David saw the place where Saul lay with Abner the son of Ner, the commander of the army. Saul was laying within the encampment while the army was encamped around him. Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Joab's brother Abishai the son of Zeruiah, 'Who will go down with me into the camp of Saul, to Saul?' And Abishai said, 'I will go down with you.' So David and Abishai went to the army by night. And there lay Saul sleeping within the encampment with his spear stuck in the ground at his head. And Abner and the army lay around him. Then Abishai said to David, God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now please let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear, and I will not strike him twice. But David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, for who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? And David said, as the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he'll go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should put out my hand against the Lord's anointed, but take now the spear that is in that is at his head and the jar of water, and let us go. So David took the spear and the jar of water from Saul's head, and they went away. No man saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So three outcomes of trusting God and pursuing his plan in his way. And the first outcome, what can we expect? The first outcome we see is that we can yield to God's sovereignty over the stuff of life. If sovereignty is too hard to spell, just put bigness. So sovereignty, I sometimes get hung up there, like S-O-V, and then I'm done. Okay. So God's bigness. We can yield to God's bigness over the stuff of life. So when chapter 25 ended, we had an update. You might have seen that at the end of chapter 25 on David's burgeoning brides. He's got three. One wife should be enough. I don't know why he needs more. He ought to know this, but he had been protected from taking matters into his own hands, and now what? And the story progresses as the scene is set. That's really what's going on in those opening verses, those opening five verses. It all sounds familiar. We're back to the rhythms of chapters 23 and 24, where people are betraying David, and in this case, it's the Ziphites again. They've already betrayed him once. Remember, that's when the Rock of Escape happened. That was the Ziphites' intelligence that had led to this. And so now they must have credible intelligence, because Saul arises and goes down with 3,000 men to seek David. And we've been down this road before. So David's outnumbered 5-1. 3,000 choice men of Israel are coming to fight against 600 men. Saul encamped on the hill, and David remained in the wilderness and sent spies to learn. And David found where he was encamped, where Saul laid, and Abner with him. Saul was in the middle with the army encamped around him. And so David asks, who will go with me into the camp? And it was agreed that Abishai would go. So they go into the camp. By night they enter the camp, and what do they found? That Saul's sleeping there among his soldiers. And what's near Saul? His spear, of course. Saul's spear. So you might write these references down. You might remember this. If there's one thing that's been consistent in every interaction with Saul and David, it's been the fact that the spear has been near. So chapter 18, verse 10, the next day a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, and he did as he did day by day, and Saul had his spear in his hand, and he hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. And David evaded him twice. Remember that? Or 1 Samuel 20:33, when Saul hurled his spear at Jonathan to strike him, so he knew that his father was determined to put David to death. Or remember the scene at the end of in chapter 22, verse 6. Saul heard that David was discovered and all the men who were with him. He was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with a spear in his hand and all of his servants standing around him. It's like, we're ready to go to war, people. We found him. You know, it's like Star Wars with the Emperor having the skills and the lightsaber and like, hey, we're all going into battle, right? Yeah, we are. That's right. Yeah, you got a spear in your hand. Yeah, we're going. Sure. Of course. If Saul's near, then so is the spear. Okay, that's kind of what's going on here. So Abner and the army surrounded Saul, and Abishai thinks that he's going to take a run at the God's anointed, like the guys did in chapter 24. It's almost the same exact wording, like, this is your moment. This is your one shining moment. God has dropped it into your lap. He is asleep. We're standing here. You have this spear. I'll drive it right through him. I'll pin him to the ground. No one will know. No movement. Your enemy will be done. This will be over quick. Let's end this right here, right now. And notice David's answer this time. Rather than trimming a robe, rather than grabbing a sword and saying, yes, to fight, we go, David says, don't destroy him. For God has this. That's basically David's explanation, right? I don't need to strike him down. God has this. God's big enough to deal with Saul. Like, remember last week, God dealt with Nabal like in half a verse. Like, Nabal's just a blubbering fool, and God deals with him. Like, and his heart stopped. And God, 10 days later, God took him. Over. God took care of this. And God can take care of Saul. That's what David says here. There's been a progression in his faith, a progression in what he trusts in God to do. David says, who can lift their hand against God's anointed and be guiltless? But God can deal with Saul just like he dealt with Nabal. So he says, as the Lord lives, the Lord may strike him, or his day will come to die. So like he could strike him down like he did Nabal. It might just be natural that he's going to live a life and die, or he's going to go into battle and perish. Let's just take the spear and the water jug and go. God's got this. So that's what they did. And then we're told how all this could happen with not one of the 3,000 men catching David's smell. I mean, you know that as shrewd as Saul is and as paranoid as he is, surely someone was assigned to guard him. I mean, surely there's someone like, okay, we're going to catch some shut-eye. I mean, we've seen this play out enough in movies. Like, you're going to get some sleep. I'll take the night watch. And yet they're all asleep, right? Asleep from the Lord. That's what verse 12 calls it. No man saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. In other words, God was in this. God was in complete control. And David had full confidence in God's sovereignty and God's bigness over the stuff of life. This test and these temptations are just like the ones Jesus faced. Do you really trust God? Do you really trust what he said in his word? Why don't you do it this way? It's the same temptation. And David responds that God's in control. God exercises bigness over the stuff of life. So is that your confidence? When life is not peachy keen, when life is not well or fine, does your trust in God lead you to conclude that his will be done? Are you yielding to his sovereignty over the stuff of life, or are you getting in the way of his sovereignty over the stuff of life? Again, our temptation is to take matters into our own hands. So what this looks like in my life is I worry, or maybe it's not worry because I know that's probably wrong. If I'm worried about this, there's a lot of verses that talk about worry. I need to be careful. So I'm just anxious. I have anxiety about this. Or I act as if all of what needs to happen is squarely on my shoulders. That if I don't do this, it's all going to be messed up. I'm forgetting that God's in control. So, lest you misunderstand, trusting God doesn't mean that we're inactive, okay? But trusting him means that we can walk with confidence through life. We can yield to his sovereignty, his bigness over life. We can trust him. David could confidently walk in obedience to God, knowing that God was in control. David could confidently know that I don't have to lift my hand against the Lord's anointed because he's the Lord's anointed. God will take care of this. God's able to like take him right now. God's able to let him live a life and die naturally. God's able to send him into battle and take him. God can do this. He's God. So I'm going to trust that. And we can walk in obedience too, with confidence that God will have his way. So I can think of the fear that we have in loving our enemies. Well, if I love the world like God tells me to, then they're going to think I'm capitulating and that I have no standards or whatever. And is that really flowing out of a trust in God and his bigness? That God's told us what to do? Well, I can't obey what God said, because if I obey what God says, then I'm going to cater to the culture. Well, really? I mean, do you think God's like not got this? I mean, do you think he's in control? I mean, it feels like we're embracing weakness as if the Son of God himself didn't have to do this. Like we position ourselves to be better than Jesus. Remember, before the glory came, he had to go through the cross. And we somehow think that in our case, we won't ever have to endure any suffering. We're just going to go straight to glory and it's all going to be rosy. When we're following someone who asks us to take up a cross, it's really more about saving our own faces to do things our way, right, than to do things God's way. We're not really trusting him, we're trusting ourselves. Who knows how God will act? That's why he gets to wear the big boy pants. Who knows? We don't know what God's going to do. We just trust that he's big enough to do it. We don't know what it's going to look like, and we just lean into that. You got this, so I'm going to trust you. I'm going to walk in your ways, and I'm going to trust you. That's what David's doing here. We can have confidence that he's with us. So one outcome of trusting God is that we yield to his sovereignty over the stuff of life. Another outcome, secondly, is that our faith can be emboldened in difficult circumstances. So begin reading with me in verse 16, so follow along with me. David went over to the other side. So remember, he's got what? The spear and the water jug. Okay, he goes to the other side. And he stood far off on the top of the hill with a great space between them. So David's on kind of on one hill, Saul's on the other. And David called to the army and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Will you not answer, Abner?" Then Abner answered, "Who are you who calls to the king?" And David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? Who's like you in Israel? Why then have you not kept watch over your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy the king, your lord. This thing that you've done is not good. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die because you have not kept watch over your lord, the Lord's anointed. And now see, where is the king's spear and the jar of water that was at his head?" So this is what's going on here. His faith is almost emboldened, right? His trust in God is so much that he almost has boldness now to speak words. An amazing turn of events that David calls out to Abner, again, over this great space. "Will you not answer? Are you not a man? You have like one job and you failed at that." It's pretty crazy. That's why I'm saying David seems emboldened here. And David basically says in verse 16, "This is not good. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die because you've not kept watch over the king, the Lord's anointed. After all, wear the king's spear and the water jug." David's basically saying, like, you all are in the wrong. You can't even guard your own king. So why are you chasing down me? This is a farce. That's what David's saying. It's just, this is crazy. You can't guard him and you're coming after me because I'm a threat? It doesn't make any sense. Showcasing David's innocence. If they can't do basic things like guard the king, why spend time going after someone allegedly threatening him? The real threat is their incompetence. That's what's going to kill the king, the fact that they can't guard him. Not David. He was there. He had the chance to kill him. So I think just this is kind of a way to see that there's a connection here to help you see that sometimes our faith in God and the confidence that he'll come through emboldens us. And we know that's to be true. Like the book of Acts. Isn't the whole story of the book of Acts that playing out one time after another? The threats the Romans make only serve to embolden the early church and their witness, right? The Romans are saying, "Hey, if you don't quit talking about this Jesus, we're going to kill you." And what do they say? Hey, that reminds me of an interesting story. Have you ever read the Old Testament? Wait, what? We said we were going to kill you if you keep talking about this name. Yeah. So here's the deal. There was this guy who lived, and you put him to death. And he rose from the dead. You know, they're just like crazy bold, right? That they have such a trust in God. Like, okay, well, now you're going in prison. Okay, well, we'll just be singing here all night because we know God has this. And, you know, it's just over and over again. They just have this crazy boldness in the midst of this situation where they're just going about God's plan and God's way. They're trusting him. And out of that is flowing this boldness. It provoked more and more. It was causing a true distillation of their confidence in God to emerge. all that suffering, all that resistance. And man, might this be the case for us? That as we trust God, as we walk in His ways, that our faith would be emboldened, even in the midst of difficult circumstances. Man, don't you want God to do that for you? It's going to mean that you sometimes have to walk through hard valleys. You have to walk through some suffering so the true trust in God can be distilled and you can just step out with boldness. So our faith is emboldened even in the midst of difficult circumstances. And finally, how all this ends, third and final outcome we see here is that we're able to hold on to hope that God will accomplish His plan. We hold on to hope. So let me read the rest of the chapter and then we'll see how this ends. Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king." And he said, "Why does my lord pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is on my hands? Now therefore let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If it's the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day that I should have no share in the heritage of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.' Now therefore, let not my blood fall to the earth away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a single flea like one who hunts a partridge in the mountains." And then Saul said, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I've acted foolishly and have made a great mistake." And David answered and said, "Here's the spear, O king. Let one of the young men come over and take it. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord gave you into my hand today, and I would not put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Behold, as your life was precious this day in my sight, so may my life be precious in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me out of all tribulation." Then Saul said to David, "Blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them." So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. So this all builds to David holding out to hope here at the end. Our passage ends with Saul, then David speaking, and so it's a night voice. It wasn't like there was a street light on in the hills of rural Ziph that night. You know, they just had the moonlight, and David's on one hill calling out to the other, Abner. There's probably like a campfire there or something. And Saul immediately recognizes that it's David's voice. And so Saul responds and confesses. This interaction is different than the one in chapter 24. Saul spoke and David responded. But now David speaks a lot more readily. He says it is his voice. And he asks Saul, "Why are you pursuing me? I'm your servant. What have I done? What evil is there?" And then he poses some scenarios, right? Like, if this is the Lord's doing, then let me come back to Israel and offer sacrifice for that, so that I can be restored to the people. But if this is men that are just putting this in your ear, may they be cursed before the Lord for driving me out of the Lord's heritage and, in essence, telling me to go serve other gods. David's sounding a lot like Abigail here, right? For Samuel 25:26, Abigail asked to let David's enemies and those who seek to do evil to my lord, to David, be as Nabal. And now Saul's saying that about the counselors to Saul. If this is men just inciting you against me, you know, may God deal with them. May they be cursed before the Lord. So David's seeking to expose the foolishness of those who have Saul's ear. So David affirms here that it's really the Lord's presence that he seeks. The king of Israel has come out to seek a flea like one hunts a partridge in the mountains. So I'm not a hunter. I don't know the history of partridge hunting in the hills of Israel. But I do know the difference between a partridge in a pear tree and a flea, right? So, I mean, I do know that much. Like, at least I've heard. So, the flea is just really small compared to the partridge, right? I mean, just imagine trying to, you know, hunt for sport, like pull the bow back and, oh, there's a partridge. Boom. Or, ooh, there's a flea. I think I can hit that. You know, it's just crazy. That's what David's saying is, this is just nuts that you would come and hunt me, that you would drive me from the people. It should not be. So what David is trying to get Saul to see is that there are covenant worshiping community implications for his actions. You may not think that it's a big deal that you're hunting me over all the countryside, but you're forcing me to go serve other gods. You're forcing me away from the people. You're forcing us to violate the covenant that we have between God. And so Saul responds by admitting that he's wrong. I've sinned. Return. And he promises, I'll do you no harm because my life was precious in your sight. I've acted the fool. I've made a mistake. And so then David has this amazing closing statement in verses 22 to 25 where he speaks with words of hope that come from righteousness and faithfulness, right? He offers the spear back and kind of shares what he's learned in the furnace of affliction over these last three chapters, that he will trust in the Lord. That's where he's going to lay. That's where he's going to be. God gave Saul into David's hand, but he wouldn't stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed. And why? Because he trusts in God's character. God's character is to reward righteousness and faithfulness. So again, as David doesn't say, as I recognized your life was precious, why don't you recognize that my life is precious? That's not what he says. He says, as I recognize your life is precious, now may the Lord recognize that my life is precious. May my life be precious in God's sight, and may he deliver me out of all tribulation. So David's just brimming. It's like spilling out this hope he has in God, that God's going to take care of him. He trusts in God, and David's done what's right, so he has all kinds of hope that God's going to do what's best. That's where his confidence is. And Saul even affirms this, right? This blessing, blessed be you, David, my son. You'll do many things and succeed in them. And they part ways again. So again, just the application here, as we're thinking about the outcomes of trusting God, yes, yielding to his bigness, just seeing that he's got this, that he's in control, that our faith, as it's strengthened, is going to be emboldened, and now that hope spills out. Are you able to relentlessly hold on to hope that God will accomplish his plan? Really, in this world, are you able to do that? You might think, well, if so-and-so gets elected, we're all going downhill. Yeah, but do you have hope that God's going to accomplish his plan, even if the worst could happen? I mean, do you really believe that God's in control? Do you have hope in him? I mean, as you walk through life in this world, do you tend to be more discouraged, or do you tend to be more filled with hope because of what you know about God? I mean, I can scroll through social media and I just be discouraged in like 5 seconds, like, you know. But then, you know, as I know God, know his word, I have to be filled with hope, right? That I have confidence in him, that God will work this out, God will reward, God will deliver. Unless you think this is all like rosy and peachy keen that I'm trying to get at, read 1 Samuel 27, because we're going to have a chapter where God's not mentioned at all. We're going to have David running for his life, seeking refuge in Philistine territory, putting trust in himself again. He's going to tell himself in his heart, Saul's still going to kill me. And so he's going to try to fix all this in his own strength. So we'll look at that next week, because some of us go there. So this isn't just mean like life is rosy, but we can look at these three events in David's life, see that there was progression, and see, man, I have to have hope in God in the midst of this. As of this situation right here, he has hope. David has hope. So again, I think the tendency is when the heat is turned up in our lives, we drift out of hope. We drift out of hope. And what does the psalmist ask? What does God want us to do? He recommends that we talk to ourselves. Like, why are you downcast, O my soul? Put your hope in God. That's the remedy. Why are you downcast? Put your hope in God. So are you doing that? Are you putting your hope in him? We can hold on to hope that God will accomplish his plan. So as we wrap all this up today, We've seen three outcomes of trusting God and pursuing His plan in His way. That's yielding to His bigness over all the stuff of life. Our faith can be emboldened even through difficult circumstances, and we're able to hold out hope, hold on to hope that God will accomplish His plan. So today, what would a trust in God look like for you? So for some of us, the reason we don't trust God is because our eyes are firmly fixed on all the circumstances of life. That's what our eyes are on. Our eyes aren't on God at all. We're looking at the circumstances of life and saying, I can't believe I have to go through this. And some of us are even trying to negotiate with God over that, right? Like, if you do this, then I'll believe in you. And who's the God there? What are we putting hope in? We're putting hope in our interpretation of what God does. That if I feel like God's done enough for me, then I'll meet Him halfway. And we're really saying that I'm my own Savior. So, you can't negotiate with God. Do this and I'll believe in you. This keeps us always in the driver's seat. It keeps us always controlling things. And this isn't trust at all. You're not trusting God if you say, do this and I'll believe in you. That's not what trust looks like. It's keeping all of our confidence for relating to Him in our lap. And so today, some of us just need to give up. We need to let go. We've been holding on to the stuff of life with tight-gripped fingers our entire life, saying, God, fix this, and then I'll believe in you. And it's not trust. Trust is looking to Him and seeing all that He has said He is, all of His character, all of His ways of relating to mankind, and saying, I'm going to put everything I can muster on that. I'm going to put all chips on that. I'm going to put all the confidence I have on that, on who He is. So unleashing the grip on our lives and saying, here, God, it's yours. You take this. So it's a turn. That's the repentance aspect of it's turning from our own way, turning from holding on to how we can fix this in ourselves and trusting His way. Putting our confidence in Jesus specifically. He's the one who was tempted in every way like us, yet without sin. You might say, well, Jesus doesn't understand what I'm going through. Well, everything you've gone through, He's gone through. I mean, He's walked that. He's walked this path. He's been disappointed by people. He's been let down. He's had friends walk away from Him. He's dealt with everything in life. Tempted in every way like us, yet without sin. He's the hope. He's the object of our faith. So let's look to Him. And if you're a believer, we believe, right? We believe this to be true. We trust Him. But man, there are so many areas of our life that are characterized by unbelief. So we need to yield to His sovereignty, His bigness. And I would just encourage you to be honest with God about what you're anxious about. Just tell Him that. He's not going to be shocked by it. In fact, He already knows what you're anxious about. But when you talk to Him about it, it just changes the dynamic. And so talk to Him about it and then just let Him have it. See, I am anxious about this, and it's yours. Would you show your bigness over this? I mean, I think about that in so many areas of life. Just things that we walk through in life. And it's when I'm anxious about it, man, the moment I can finally say, this is yours. I trust you. Then all of a sudden, it's like a weight is lifted and, oh man, I can walk. It doesn't mean I have no responsibilities. But His control is better than mine. And His control over all the stuff of life is better than yours too. For others, it's a faith issue. So we just need to ask God to strengthen our trust in Him through all the junk of life. Like, let this strengthen my faith so that I trust you more and so that I have boldness in the midst of that. And for others, we just need hope. We need hope that God will accomplish His plan, and He will accomplish His plan. You know, like the old Southern Gospel song said, I've read the back of the book and we win, you know. Like, God's plan will be accomplished. And I think how this is going to work is something like this. This is the best way I can put it together in my mind. Someday, in eternity, we're going to look back over our lives. And we're going to see this amazing canvas that God was painting our entire existence, all for His glory. And as we look at that painting, there's going to be paint on the canvas that seems dark, that seems like wicked. Those are deep shades of black, deep dark grays, deep navy blues. And those aren't going to be there like in my life just because those are my favorite colors. They're going to be there because that's when God was working through all the suffering of my life to bring Him self-glory. And so I have hope. I have hope that His plan is going to be accomplished, and that as I look back over all the canvas of what He's done to save me from start to finish, that all of that is going to bring Him great glory. The life He's accomplishing in you will, in the end, bring Him that. So today, let's yield to Him. Let's trust Him. Let's embrace the hope that His will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Let's rest in these truths, and as we do, we'll be a people who glorify and enjoy Him forever.